I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. We call it An American Conversation with Global Attitude. This one is a digressive walk and talk through a master collection of those Soviet posters we all sort of half know and half recoil from. Those cult images of Lenin in the 20s, Stalin in the 40s and 50s. Those icons of flawless Russian workers and rapacious capitalist pigs. The pigs are us, of course, but all those over-the-top images are long ago and far enough away now to bear a fresh look. We're looking and listening with Tom Gleason, the Russian historian at Brown University, who pulled together this show of 20th century cartoons and calls to arms at the Bell Gallery on the Brown campus. History and high humor and beauty, too, are threaded through these posters. And something like a pop version of the evolution of Russia's modern art. Tom Gleason, reflexively we get our dukes up around these posters, and then we remember, wait a second, it's a different century, a different world, and then you can't take your eyes off these things, the art of them, the variety, the humor, sometimes hilarious, the design of them, as well as the politics, but the evolution of style, modern lithography. The whole thing. Where do you want to begin? Walk us around this show.
Let me talk first about things that belong together and don't belong together in different cultures. We here it would be a very, very rare situation in which we would have paintings by modernists hanging alongside political cartoons, hanging alongside posters advocating this, that, or the other thing. We have made a sort of separation of the fine arts from applied arts, advertising, caricature, political cartoons that doesn't really exist there or didn't really exist there. So this show crosses a lot of boundaries that we've set up which define the sort of art that we see at any one time.
And yet the poster is in itself a kind of category.
The poster is a modern invention. The poster really comes into formal existence around the time of the French Revolution or, the late 18th century. It presupposes, I think, the existence of a kind of coherent public opinion that needs to be swayed in some way. It tells the French it's time to fight the Germans. It tells the sans-culottes that it's time to fight the bourgeoisie. It tells the lawyers that it's time to defend Dreyfus. So it is a public art. And I wonder sometimes if in the United States our concepts of art have not gotten so arcane and private and hermetic, if I can use three academic words right in a row, so out of the way that we're ready to turn to the poster and see something which is straightforward and commands you or persuades you or wants you to do something, and it's public and it's out there and it's blunt and it's bold.
Our bumper stick is, in a way.
Yes, actually, that's a very good analogy. I'd never really thought of that. But they are a little bit like bumper stickers. And for college students for some time now, this has been the age of the bumper sticker, and for everybody else. But around my university, I'm used to seeing these students' cars with 10 bumper stickers and other material plastered all over them. In a way, these are posters on wheels in some sense.
Yeah, or T-shirts that say, you know, in boldness lies genius, or that say question authority or Obama or anything else.
Yeah, I think that's right. So these are passionately public things. And somehow or other, when they're divorced from any specific political context that you might want to debate, as I think they now are, we're liberated to see them very differently and to assess them and to find them in harmony or disharmony with our own time and to see them freshly. And that was really what the show was meant to do, to put them up there so that people could take a look at them and see whether they didn't see them differently than they did in 1985 or in 1945.
Tom, these posters scream propaganda. Whether you're talking the personality cult of Lenin, that brilliant red and white face of the all-important man, or one of my favorite posters in here is that one of two scenes In one case, the top-hatted, black-suited capitalist is stepping on the red-shirted worker, and in the other one, the red-shirted worker has finally got the knife at the capitalist's throat. I mean, these are really confrontational. They're over the top. They're unbelievable in a certain way, and yet somebody must have believed them. Where does this kind of extreme quality come from?
Well, I think the extreme quality comes in the case of these posters from two different sources which sort of flow into each other. On the one hand, Russian culture is a culture of extremes and a culture in which opposite qualities can be often privileged, as it were, simultaneously, where the deep religiosity can be combined with a desire to profane sacred things, where a passionate desire for justice can be combined with a passionate desire for revenge. Russian culture is a religious culture. God and the devil have both lasted far into modern times in a way that they haven't in art and culture of any other European nation. So God and the devil are both present, I think, in these posters. And on the other hand, Marxism is also, in its way, even in its somewhat diluted Soviet form, Marxism is also a culture of extremes colliding. It is a culture of bourgeois versus proletariat, of feudal versus bourgeois. It is a culture which says, in order for our world to flower, their world must be destroyed. To put it in terms of a New Yorker animal cartoon that I recently saw, two dogs are talking. One of them says to the other, it's not enough for dogs to prosper. Cats must be destroyed. And the other dog nods wisely.
Speaking of animals, let's acknowledge the pigs in these posters. I mean, this is the apotheosis of the pig in art. I'm thinking of that gorgeously bursting pink pig on which the Pope and Wall Street and Nazis and all sorts of people are riding. But then also a very stark, simple black and white poster in which this kind of stalwart Soviet troop is standing, barring the gate to these ravenous pigs that are assaulting him. What's this thing all about?
Well, the pig, of course, is capitalism. Now that the Soviet Union is not only is over, but has been out of the way for what's approaching now a generation, the loss of a world in which the Soviet Union was included led, I think, to the triumph of capitalism as an economic system. We often heard that. We were told endlessly that greed was good. Now it's been more than 15 years. It's been almost 20 years since those things began to be said. There is no Soviet threat. There virtually in the world is no left, in the ordinary sense of the term. So we are in the middle of a world in which capitalism has triumphed. This is a crucial moment when all over the world, I think, what's happened is being called into question. So it seems to me this is an ideal time for people to receive propaganda which is not now associated with Soviet threats or terrorism, but can speak to people very, very directly. Isn't capitalism a pig, we are asked? Well, I won't presume to give an answer to that, but the question is more interesting than it has been in a long time.
Chase that. Is there a revival in some fashion of this message as capitalism takes a vacation?
Well, I think we might be getting there. Now, where this will lead is not at all clear to me. There's nobody around saying, in public at least, no person of any consequence saying that capitalism is maybe not the economic system we all need in the end of the day. But I think a great many people are feeling it, or a great many people are feeling, without knowing how to express it, that somehow we're profoundly on the wrong track. I mean, if you look even at public statistics in the United States, you see that. So when people see capitalism as a pig or as some awful animal sucking the vital juices out of people's stomachs, people are not turned off by that the way they were during the Cold War. There's no possibility of being considered to be pro-Soviet, and if you just let your feelings speak for you, people will respond to that. Again, I have no idea whether this is more than a fitful mood in the American public and probably the European public as well. But I do think there is currently a feeling that capitalism is not a huge success, and that something more is desirable and needed, and there is a willingness to look at the greed and the inequality promoted by capitalism with a somewhat more sympathetic eye than has been possible in the past.
These posters are still way over the top, but there's something plausible inside that critique.
Well, again, I think it's the present time. And I think, you know, if you look at Russia today and you look at the United States today, most people look at them antagonistically, but the one thing that's happened in both societies since the Soviet Union came to an end is that inequality has increased, both in Russia and in the United States. Russia has its own demonic form of capitalism, and the United States' capitalism is looking, if not demonic, at least like a partial failure to a great many people. So that I think capitalism as a pig is something that people are prepared to look at a bit.
Speak about the art here, Tom. Some of it's extraordinary. There's a design look and feel and range of experimentation with lithography. There's also just plain some genius cartooning and shall we say, I don't know, David Levine style caricature and masterful drawing to effect. My favorite might be that very womanish treatment of Hitler. It looks like a woman with a broom. In fact, it's the Führer with a bloody axe in his hands, but a kind of skirt around his uniform and a portrayal of the body makes him very much a kind of Hausfrau of some sort. That's one of many, but which of the artists here draw your eye and continued respect?
Oh, well, a number of them, and not just the Kukriniksi, the three who did those wonderful political watercolors and pen and ink drawings, not just Yefimov and Zhytomyrsky, but others as well. But, you know, the thing is that in that world, in the world of these Soviet socialism, the world of what they used to call truly existing socialism, a great many people who might have become different kinds of painters here were drawn into areas where they could express themselves a little bit more freely. They were drawn into a children's book illustration. They were drawn into political cartooning and into the making of posters, where the very, very restrictive, exacting standards that governed what we might think of for the moment as high art were relaxed somewhat. And people had a chance to be expressive. So I think when we look at a comparison between the caricatures and cartoons of our world and of that world, their world, we might say, the talent that was drawn into doing this kind of thing in their world was more substantial. And also the scope for these cartoons, the purpose for them, the importance of them was much greater. So they had a larger share of Russian talent than comparable work had in the United States, where you didn't have to go there, as kids would say today.
Tom, it fascinates me that the villainy in these posters shifts so quickly after World War II to the United States. The fire that had been trained on the kulaks and then on Hitler is suddenly trained on us. Truman, Harry Truman, beating a war drum makes a shadow in silhouette in the back of Hitler. John D. Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, Dean Acheson, Dwight D. Eisenhower suddenly become targets of real rage. What are we to make of this?
Well, there's a great deal to be said in that. Let me try to begin with something that I don't think is said often enough. And that is that the audience for these after 1945, especially in the 50s and 60s, the audience for this kind of work is a much more educated audience. If you were targeting peasants and workers in the 1920s, you weren't going to really concentrate on individuals. Even though European statesmen appear in political cartoons about the Entente, it's not really that important to expose Karl Kautsky, the wrong-thinking German socialist. But after the war, capitalism is personified by the American political leadership. And obviously, also, Tito becomes a target. How can you dramatize what's happened in Yugoslavia unless you go after Tito personally? So I think we're into a world where the audience for this work is more educated and more able to make distinctions. And this is also a struggle for the minds of educated people. It is not a struggle for the souls of peasants.
I wonder sometimes who actually believed these posters, who saw them, but then who took them straight? Did anybody? Dr. Bernard Laun was speaking to us the other day. He said the difference is that we speak of Soviet propaganda, but the Russians didn't believe their propaganda. The difference, he says, is that Americans believe the front page of the New York Times. I guess my question is, what's the level of irony that the artists brought to these works and that people brought to them when they saw them?
You know, that's a very interesting observation. I guess I'd only go part way with it, or maybe a little way with it. You know, there's a difference between believing a specific story about the bad guys as defined by your society and believing a much more general kind of view of the bad guys on the other side. I think it's true that, and it's very hard to know for sure, but I think it's true on balance that there was a higher degree of skepticism on the Russian side. That is to say, they didn't believe the stories that Pravda and Izvestia had on the front page. And there, of course, there was the old joke, there's no truth in Pravda and no news in Izvestia. But you know, they did take in the sort of ambiance. They really did believe that capitalism was bad and it was better to have a socialist system, or at least there was a wide degree of belief in those things. On our side, it is possible, as Laun suggests, that the degree of credulity about the other side was greater. And it's certainly the case that ordinary Americans believed very specifically in the evils of the Soviet Union. But I think it's very difficult to know to what degree these artists believed in, were sincere about what they were painting and drawing. I think undoubtedly this varied from person to person. But on the whole, they may have thought in many cases that they were denouncing real sins or real crimes or real inequities. And they had to do it in terms of what the leadership told them to do. They had to pin it on the United States. But surely when a Jewish cartoonist is drawing something about the crime of American racism, the shame of American racism, surely he thinks, yes, and the Americans are not the only people who have something to be ashamed of.
The racism theme is fascinating in history. I mean, to look at these posters, you'd think the United States was the land exclusively of John D. Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, and lynch mobs. Nothing of those other Americans that we know the Russians were interested in, including Joe Louis and Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong. What is to say of the wisdom, unwisdom, depth, or just pure opportunism of this caricature of us?
Well, of course, the Russians were very interested in those people, very interested in Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, very interested in American popular culture, very ambivalent about it at the political level, fascinated at the individual level. On the other hand, posters are not made for nuance. There's no nuance in posters. A poster is good for pasting somebody, for saying, you're a jerk, you're a cruel son of a bitch. It's not good for saying, well, you are a great artist, but you're flawed. Posters can't do that. The leadership wasn't interested in, they were not even interested in their own appreciation for American popular culture, which undoubtedly existed. Stalin himself loved American movies better than any other kind. But why make a poster about that? You're not doing what posters are supposed to do. Posters are about who your friends are, who the great people are, who your enemies are, who the villains are, who God is and who the devil is. That's what posters can do.
You make the point that we can look at the critique of capitalism, even the extreme critique, the posterization of capitalism, a little differently now. Is it far enough away that we can look at this picture of 50s America, including lynching, in a different way and get a different kind of insight from this Russian caricature of it?
Well, you know, I don't know the answer to that. And when we put the show together, I didn't know how people were going to take it. I got the opportunity, along with Ms. Conklin, to select the material that went into the show. And I found myself getting more and more interested in it as we put it together. I really don't know to what degree Americans in general, or in some quantity, are prepared to look differently at Soviet art. But my experience so far with the show suggests that at least around the university, and at least for some people, they share my reaction a bit.
It's a completely fascinating show, Tom, at so many levels, visually, graphically, politically, historically, internationally. It's hugely interesting. Wherefore, we put about 20 of the most wonderful images on our page. I hope folks will look them up on our site, radioopensource.org. Tom Gleason, Russian historian emeritus at Brown University, thanks enormously for the show. Thanks for this conversation.
Always a pleasure, Chris.
Sarah Archambault produced and edited this conversation. Sarah also transported a score of the images we've been talking about into a slideshow of Soviet posters on our website at radioopensource.org. Have a look and leave your own two bits on Soviet posters in a comment, please. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thanks for joining the conversation.